And then we said that it all depends upon who's tokev, who's power, and is it Achashverosh, is it Mordechai, is it Haman, or is it the miracle of Purim itself?
Yeah,
and that determines from where we are obligated to read the Megillah.
Oh, the obligation.
Obligated, right, obligated to read the Megillah. Okay? All right. Rabbeinu Amar, he said, Lehocho. Let's see, did I skip anything over here? Okay, right. He says that the reason why we have four different opinions is based not on the pasuk that we just cited, but rather on this pasuk. What is the pasuk? The pasuk says, Omar Reru al Kocho, Omar Higi Alehem, which means, what did the Jews see al Kocho concerning this? Omar Higi Alehem, what happened unto them? So now we're going to analyze each of these three phrases over here in this particular sentence. Manda Omar Kula, the one who says you have to read the entire Megillah right from beginning to end. So he says, Maro or Achashverosh. What did Achashverosh see? Shenishtamesh Bekelem Shabes Hamikdosh. This we had in the first chapter, that he made use of the holy vessels that had been taken originally by the Babylonians from the Beis HaMikdosh, the first Beis HaMikdosh. If you remember, in other words, he took, you know, the goblets and so on, and he drank the wine in them. He used them for his banquets, right? Right. Al Kocha, it was for this reason. What is the reason? Mishim Dechoshev Shim Shneen Vala Yifruk. Because he calculated that 70 years had passed since the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and still the Jews had not been redeemed, and so he felt, I mean, as we had also in the first chapter, that, you know, he felt that, so there's no more hope that the Jews will ever have any more a second Beis HaMikdash or anything like that, and so therefore, I'm free now to make use of these and do whatever I want with them, okay, with these vessels. So, Umar Yalehem, and what was the result? What happened after that? So the answer is the Kotel Vashti. He killed Vashti. And of course, by killing Vashti, then that made room eventually for whom?
Esther.
For Esther. Okay.
I realize that. Why did they bring in killing Vashti there?
Because this happened immediately after he did that, after he drank. Mm. You know, in other words, it's all in the first chapter of the Megillah. Mm. Therefore, according to Rabbi Meir, we have to read from the beginning of the first chapter. That's what the very idea is, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Amar Omar, and the one who is of the opinion, Meish Yehudi, that of course we said is Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, right? That you begin reading where it speaks about Mordechai. So he says, Maro Mordechai, Deikne Bahaman. Why? What did Mordechai see that he decided to provoke Haman, right? In other words, what did he refuse to do? He refused to bow down to him, remember? Okay. What did he see? I mean, what was the reasoning behind it? So, Al Kocha, it was for this reason. What was the reason? The Shavu Nafshei Avodah Zarah. It was because Haman had declared himself, or had decided that he was like an idol, and therefore that they have to bow down unto him, okay? And what was the result that happened? The Israchish Nisa. The result was, of course, that a miracle eventually occurred. Alright. Now, so that therefore, according to that opinion, this is the momentous moment, if you wish, in the story of the Megillah, therefore the obligation begins at this point. As I said, that was Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. Umanda Omar. And this was Rabbi Yossi's opinion, the one who says that Me'achad Vav'Ela, in other words, with the beginning of the third chapter, right, where it speaks about the how Haman became high and mighty, right? So Mara Haman, and what does Haman see? Sheniskane b'chol ha'yehudim, that he wanted to take it out on all the Jews. I mean, we can understand why he wanted to take it out on Mordechai. But why all the Jews? So it's our kocho. It was for this reason, Mishum the Mordechai lo yichrav liyishtachada, right? That Mordechai refused to bend the knee and would not prostrate himself. And what happened eventually? What happened eventually is we saw the worst thing is one of our raids. They hanged him and his sons on the tree, on the gallows. Okay?
Why is that important?
It's important from the point of view of, you know, Rabbi Yossi, because if Haman had not decided to kill all the Jews, then, you know, all the events that happened, you know, would never have happened. Including the fact that he himself eventually was punished because he wanted to destroy all the Jews, so he and his sons were therefore punished.
Why did he just take it out on Mordechai? Mordechai was the only one that refused to bow to him.
Yeah.
Why did he decide to kill all the Jews as a result of that?
It's a good question, but the answer is he was an anti-Semite. Period.
Well, I think it was more if I could just raise an idea. If you remember, when he talks to Ahasuerus, he says, you know, you have a people that violate your laws. They don't obey your laws, your edict.
Right.
So I think there's more like a reason of state here that he felt he was the grand vizier or whatever. He felt, well, if this Mordechai was evidently the leading citizen of the Jewish community or representative, if he's represented or symbolized, then you had a whole group of people who were going to be, if not rebellious, at least not very good subjects.
All right. But David, you have to remember, this is what he told the king, but was that really his motivation? He knew that he was telling a lie about that. Yeah. But that didn't stop him from telling a lie. Does it stop any of the Arabs from telling lies about the Jews, even if they know how ridiculous it is?
It's not that what he said was true. It's not that the content of it was true, but did he believe it to be true?
No, I don't believe that he believed it either. I think he was out and out Russia, and he knew he was lying. You mean to say that Goebbels didn't know that he was lying when he would print everything or whatever?
You know, they know.
Allah Ram doesn't know that it's telling a lie, for example, when it says that the Jews use the Egyptian blood in order to bake matzah or cookies for Pesach or for whatever it was. They know.
Right.
I'll have to talk about this another time. Okay. This could go on for hours. Yeah. Right.
You're trying to be a defense attorney for
him. I believe that Goebbels believed the things that he wrote about the Jews.
I don't think he was that naive to believe that.
I'm not sure. I mean, this is somewhat, you know, you're saying that hate has a basis of sophistication. I'm not sure.
I'll tell you.
In my opinion, that whether he believed it or didn't believe it, I think what matters is what he did. And what he did,
that's a good proof.
What he did, the same thing with Haman.
The fact remains that he
did this thing for whatever his motivation, he did the thing that was going to destroy the people. The area was such where the Jews were living freely to do as they pleased. They were permitted they were accepted, and even in the conquered, they operate much like the city-states of Greece where they...
But they certainly had, Bezdins, you know, that were able to control Jewish life, that they had. But still they were subservient to the laws of the royal court as well. There's no question about that. They were already in those days living in two civilizations, just as we live in two civilizations today. We're Jews, we're Americans. That's the way it goes. Yeah. All right, let's see. How did I get over here? Okay. Right, okay, so we said that already. The result was that all of us are one of all things. Okay. And the fourth opinion that we quoted, Shimon ben Yochai, Mibalaila Hahu, that you begin reading with the fifth chapter over there, right? That night that King Ahasuerus couldn't sleep. Why did it suddenly fall into Ahasuerus' mind to take a look at the record books? So as Al Kochet was for this reason, the Zaminta Yester Lahoman Bahade. He was already upset by what? By the fact that Esther had invited Haman to have dinner with them alone. So if you remember, we had one opinion expressed where Esther goes to the king and she says, you know, kasher avarati avarati, in other words, she's prepared to give up her life. But part of the reason was maybe that she could make the king jealous of Haman. Remember, we had that. That's why she invited Haman to the dinner, that maybe, you know, the king would then become suspicious. How come she invites him? Is there an affair going on between them, something
the
like that?
According to this, the praise that Esther and Haman was trying to kill him.
Well, okay. But that would be as a result of what? That maybe there's an affair or something between them, right? Okay. Grasse is correct, by the way. Coup de grasse. Yeah, right. I mean, that was the final, that was the last straw over there. Right, okay. All right, so, and what was the result is Rachashisa, that the miracle occurred. All right. Omer Rav Chelbo, Omer Rav Chomer Bar Gurya. Rav Chelbo said in the name of Chomer Bar Gurya, Omer Rav, who said in the name of Rav, he says, Halacha, the law is Kedivei HaOmer Kula. The law follows the opinion of the one who says they have to read the entire Megillah. Okay? Ba'afilu, and even in accordance with the opinion, Raman Omar, of the rabbi who said that you begin reading the Yishuhudi, which is the second chapter, but nevertheless, Tzericho Shetahe Kesuva Kula. Nevertheless, you must have a complete Megillah in front of you when you read it. Okay? The other Rav Chelbo, Rav Chelbo Bar Gurya, another teaching of Rav, the name of Rav, he says, Megillah Nikrei Sefer, the Nikrei Segeris. You have, in reference to the Megillah, two different words. One is the word Sefer, which implies like a Sefer Torah, you understand? And the other one says that it is Igeres, a letter. So, Nikrei Sefer, in what way is it compared, you know, to a Sefer Torah? He says, She'im tefora b'chute pishtam psula. The law is, you know, that we have what we call Yerios, in other words, sheets of parchment upon which you write, and then what happens? You have to you have to sew them together. Now, what can you use in order to sew them together? The answer is only what we call giddin. Giddin is sinews, right? Sinews of it, the kosher animal. You understand? That's what you sew with. Okay. So it says she'im tofer bechutei pishtan, that if, for example, he used not the giddin, but he simply used, let's say, threads of flax in order, you know, cotton of flax or something like that, in order to, you know, to sew the parchments together, psula, then this Megillah is no good. It's invalid. Okay. Okay. If you use threads of flax, linen threads, right, instead of using the animal sinews, okay?
The animal had to be the cow, right?
Yeah, it has to be a kosher animal. It could be a cow, a sheep, yeah.
Yes.
No, it's not veins.
Ligaments.
Ligaments,
muscles.
Right. If I can show you that, you know, they're strong and they're like strings, okay?
Do I assume that they have to be cleansed in some way?
Yeah, of course, we're not talking about that, absolutely. Yeah, you don't take it right from the animal. You have to have a dead animal that you shecht and so on and so forth. I mean, that's be kosher. And, you know, you save parts, this would be one of the parts that you would save it, okay? Yeah.
Yeah. Wait, so all of our Torahs are
exactly. They're all sewn together with that. Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, deteriorate with time?
As a general rule, it doesn't deteriorate because it's really tough stuff. However, what happens sometimes is that the holes into which they're sewn may become a little widened or something like that, and then it's liable to fall out. Then in that case, they have to repair it. Okay?
All right. Another question just about you. I hear this both in English and in Hebrew. Flax. What exactly is flax?
Flax is a plant that grows, and from that you make linen.
You make linen?
You make linen out of it, right. Right.
Oh, okay, so, all right, so you actually make linen out of it.
Right, right. Cotton is a plant, and you make cotton fibers out of it, right? Linen is also a plant. Right.
And the
parchment. Yeah. I thought linen was like a generic.
No. It comes out of the flax plant. Right. Yes, of course. Yeah, it has to be from a kosher animal, absolutely. Usually it's, sheep. But centuries and centuries ago, I've seen a Sefer Torah that was made out of cowhide. Yeah. Which is perfectly kosher, but it's not preferred. Why? Cowhide becomes very dark and becomes hard to read against the varaz. With the sheepskin, it's light, it's white, right? And so that they put dark letters, you write dark letters on it, it's easier to read. Yeah. All right, let me finish just a little bit over here. Shebal Dinazega. Okay. All right. The Nikrei Geras, and why is the Megillah also called a letter? Alright. Unlike a Sefer Torah, which is larger, you understand? So that you have to have one, two, three, four, at least, maybe five different holes in which you thread the, okay? A Megillah is usually smaller. Let's say the Megillah would be this in size or something like that. But nevertheless, you have to have one, two, three places, where you thread it together, okay?
With the one piece.
Rarely. I mean, because for the average sofer, it's easier to write a few columns on one, and then to take another piece of parchment to write them another few, and then you sew them all together. You understand?
They sewed in some way.
Yeah, well, you have to make a hole in order to put in with the needle.
They didn't have a three-hole punch.
No. They have to do it one by one, of course, with a needle.
With a needle.
With a needle, you're right, yeah. Okay? And the same needle also is threaded with the gid.
I'm just interested, Sylvia, the same sofer who has the skill and the calligraphy also becomes like the sofer, like the seamstress? I mean, does he also...
Well, for this,
Or is it a different person?
No. In this particular case, usually, if a sofer has the experience, so he has the experience already in how to put it together, by using the needle and the gid. Okay? All right.
Do they own the sheep or the lat, do they not?
Yes. Yeah, of course, right.
Yeah.
Of course.
It's not that they're edge to edge.
No, you can't do it that way. No, you have to do it that way. Right, yeah. Omar Rav Nachman, Rav Nachman said, he says that they should be evenly spaced, that you should have three even spaces between them. All right. Omar Rav Yehuda, Omar Rav Shmuel, Rav Yehuda said the name of Shmuel, says, HaKorei b'megila aksuv bin aksuvim lo yotza. In those days, the Bibles were always written on parchment. We still have parchments over here, individual parchments for some of the Megillahs. Okay, I spoke about that, I think, last week, if I'm not mistaken. So, they also would put several together, sew them together. So here's the situation. He says that if you read a Megillah, which is written among the third part of the Bible, which we call Ksuvim, in other words, Psalms and Proverbs and Job, and then you have the various other Megillahs like Sherashim, Esther, Ruth, etc., etc., right? So if it's a part of that, then he says, no, Yossi, you did not fulfill your obligation. In other words, what does he say? You should have a separate Megillah for Megillah Esther, right? Omar Rava, Rava qualifies only. He says, Le'a Moron, Evan Le'a Nechasra, Umiyatra. Puta. He says, this is so if there was simply one continuous thing. In other words, he went from one book to the other without a break. But he says, if you left out some space, or if you put in a little bit extra space in between or something like that, then in that case, it doesn't matter. That's what he says. Okay.
So you are using this
one. Yeah.
Oh, you have to put like blank.
Right.
Blank space.
Right.
I guess to separate.
Yeah. Separate. All right. I'll just do one more line over here so that we can go to the next side of the page. It says, okay, Levi Bashmuel, Avakor Kore Kameda Rav Yehuda B'Megila. So Levi, the son of Shmuel, was reading before Rav Yehuda in a Megila, and instead of giving out the extra sheet for one more line, we'll do that next time in Yirat Hashem. But at any rate, Aksuma ben Aksuma, and it was a Megillah which was part of a larger work written with others, other books of the scriptures. So Amalei, so said to him, Hare Amru Akur ben Megillah Aksuma ben Aksuma Liyotza, said, how come you're reading such a Megillah? Because didn't we learn that a Megillah which is simply part of a larger collection of books, you haven't fulfilled your obligation, right? So Omer Rav Chiya bar Rava, Omer Rav Yochanan. So Rav Chiya bar Rava said the name Rav Yochanan. Akori b'Megillah Aksum ben Aksum leYotza, right? So he quotes the fact, you know, that the Rav Yochanan said that the person who reads in the Megillah, which is part of, you know, written among other books of the Bible, it's not fulfilled the obligation. So it says Mocha. So what happened is that they decided literally to knock it on the head, which means that, okay, they tempered it down a little bit. What did they say? It says, but Sibur Shonu. In other words, if you read the Megillah for a community, for a congregation, then in that particular case, you have to have a separate Megillah. But if you're just reading for yourself, privately, then in that case you'll be yotze if you read it. Okay, so that resolves that, and we'll save the rest in the interest of the next time.
Alright, first of all, tonight is the 12th of June, and it's already the night of the 3rd of Tammuz at this particular point, year 2002, and we are continuing from where we left off at our last session in Masachas Megillah. We're on Daf Yutes of a base, that's 19b, and we are a few lines from the top at this particular point. Right. But we had the very last time, I mean, what you heard a couple of words of before when I reviewed over here, is the fact does, when we read a Megillah, does it have to be separate from other books of the Bible, or can it be part of other books of the Bible? Particularly, we're talking about the fact that in those days, everything was written on parchment, it was handwritten, you see.
Right.
So the question is whether you would be yotzei, whether you would be fulfilling the obligation, the mitzvah, reading the Megillah on Purim, if you did it not from a single Megillah, which has, you know, Megillah Esther in it, but from a Bible which contained also Megillah Esther in it. Okay? All right. So, at first I said, nothing doing, not allowed, right?
All
right.
That's right on the line. Not allowed. That's the third line where it says, Rabbi Yochanan says, Akore ben Megillah, Aksuva ben Aksuva, Lo Yotza, right?
Yeah.
You read from Megillah, which is written among other books of the Bible, then you do not fulfill the mitzvah.
Right.
So then it says, Mochale Abecha. And then they gave it a knock on the head. In other words, they weakened this argument by saying, well, it's not quite that way, but they said, Mitzibru Shanu. What they say is that if you're reading for the congregation, then it should be from a separate Megillah. But if you had a Megillah type Bible, you know, and this was part of, included in that case, you would be Yotze for yourself. This is what they're saying. So along the same lines, we have another statement. Yomar Rabbi Chiya bar Abba bar Rabbi Yochanan. Again, statement by Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, the name of Rabbi Yochanan. It says, Shir Hatfar Halach L'Moshe Min Sinai. It says, when it comes to how many stitches you are to put in when you join one sheet of parchment with another sheet of parchment, he says, this is a Halach L'Moshe Min Sinai. Halach L'Moshe Min Sinai means that this is a tradition that goes right back to Moshe Rabbeinu,
And by tradition, which is accepted by everybody, that there has to be a certain spacing between them in order to make sure that, you know, it's in accordance with the proper tradition. So again, lo and behold, the mocha lo amocha. So again, they knock it on the head by saying, it means that they knock down the argument a little, okay? They give it a clap on the head to knock down the argument a little, right? The blow, right.
Mocha is the blow, okay.
Mocha is the word, right. Noach is the brain. Yes. They knock it upon its brain, literally.
Oh,
okay.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
So it's a figure
right.
Of
course it is.
Yeah.
And what do they say? They say the Noah Moru, the Noah Mu, but they did not say this except Allah Kadesha Yikora. The reason being is that the Sefer Torah should not tear. That's the reason why the stitches with the what we call the gilim, in other words, the like the strings that come from the animal, right?
Skin,
yeah,
skin.
It's not skin.
It isn't skin.
No,
it's
like veins.
They make like a right,
like tendons. Like
tendons. Skin. That's right. Yeah, that's much closer to it. Okay.
Yeah.
They use it. You know, they
dry it.
They dry it, and it then becomes like a cord. Only it's much stronger than the cord.
They use in surgery.
Yeah, something like that.
Sutures,
all right. Okay. Good, good, good.
These are tendons of the animal.
Right, right. So it has to come from a kosher animal, just as the, and, you know, and the stitching has to be, like the space we had before.
Spaced,
but, yeah, but it has to be spaced over here, here, here. In other words, in like you're dividing it, three stitches over here, right, and pretty much equal distance, you know, from the top to the bottom. Okay? Another statement, Hinu Rabchir Bar Abba, Abba Rabbi Yochanan. So, here is another statement. As I told you, very often you find that inasmuch as they remember, as they mention a certain person, what he had to say, so they'll throw in already two or three or four other statements that that same person made, because this was had to be memorized. You know, it was Teresh Abal Peh. Had to be memorized. So the way they could memorize it is by, right, you know, what we call like making a mnemonic device, okay?
Right.
All right. So here's another statement by the same authority. It says, okay, so now I have to tell you first of all, I'll give you the background, okay? The background is, as far as Moshe Rabbeinu is concerned, you may remember in Pasha Kesisa, he asked the Rabbeinu Shalom, right, he says, Hareini Nes Kvodecha, please, O God, show me your glory. So Hashem said to him, you know, no one can see me and live. But nevertheless, he says, I'll put you into a cleft in the rock over there, according to here, it's like in a cave, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And you will see, you know, part, right, you will see the back, you will see part of my glory, but you cannot see all of my glory, okay? Eliyahu HaNavi also, he fled from Acha from persecution, and he had a revelation from the Rabbeinu Shalom. Very famous passage where it's written, you know, he's complaining, they don't listen to me, whatever I've done, it's going down the drain and everything else, you know. And, you know, and he questions, you know, what was his purpose, you know. And so the Rabbeinu Shalom tells him, he says, and he passes this wind that blows, goes by, but the Rabbeinu Shalom is not there in the wind. And then the thunder goes by, right, earthquake and so on. And still, Rabbeinu Shalom is not there. Finally, where does Rabbeinu Shalom appear? It appears, Kol Demomadaka, in a soft, quiet voice. This is where the Rabbeinu Shalom is. In other words, it isn't just with thunder and lightning that the Rabbeinu Shalom works, but he also has to work, you know, with a soft conscience, appealing to a person's intelligence, his heart, his emotions, his feeling. This is where it is. So, the statement over here now is that if it weren't for the fact that the Rabbeinu Shalom showed, let's read it again, okay? It says, Amar Rabbi Yochanan says, if a machat tikkis, if only a tiny hole about the size of the head of a needle, yeah, in which you can put thread, right? If that was the only aperture in the cave, they would have been unable, in other words, neither Moshe nor Eliyahu would have been able to withstand the revelation of Hashem because of the brightness, because of the light that God radiates. So, in other words, we have to assume that where they were in complete darkness. Because if they had even just one little tiny dot of the light of the Ben Shalom had come in over there, they would not have been able to live. Shemayamah, of course, the pasuk says, but this is in connection with Moshe Rabbeinu, says, one can see me and live. Okay? The Yomarab Chiyah Barab Yomarab Yochanan, another statement attributed to him, it says, my desir, what is the meaning of, we have a pasuk in the Torah, happens to be in Parsha Ekev, when we'll be reading Deuteronomy. Do you remember in the verse, Moshe Rabbeinu recounts to the people of Israel all the events that had taken place before in order to reinforce their faith in God and the love for God, and also to give them various dinim and so on, that either he wanted to impress them again by repeating, or in some cases dinim which were not mentioned previously, but you know, God had revealed them unto Moshe, and he had to to teach them to the people of Israel. So, in reference, Baruch Hashem. In reference to the giving of the Torah on Mount Sinai, right? It says, "V'aleihem," and upon them, meaning upon the Shnei Luchos Habus, upon the two tablets of the law, right? Kichol hadvarim, according to all the words asher dibar Hashem lachem b'chor, which God had spoken unto you on the mountain. So, but it says v'aleihem, and on them, according to all the words. So the question is, what besides the Ten Commandments is implied over here in this verse? You understand? This is the question. So it says, "Belamed." He says that Sheherei Hakadosh Baruch Hu to Moshe, that he showed unto Moshe, that the Rebbeinu Shalom showed unto Moshe, Dikdukei Torah, Dikdukei Sofrin. Okay, showed him first of all Dikdukei Torah. In other words, the exact wording of the Torah, exactly the way it is to be written. What letters, you know, because sometimes maybe instead of a hey, it should be an aleph, or the other way around, or something like that. Or, as I told you, you know, sometimes a yod is left out, and sometimes a yod is put in, you know, like for floor landing, sometimes and so on. Right. So this is Dukta Kaitara. The Dukta Sefrin, this we have to say that, you know, the. These are, yeah, Dukta Kaitara. These are the the traditions that were given to the early Talmudic authorities, and which were to be preserved and cherished by the later generations to come of scholars. Okay.
You're implying here that God dictated those to Moshe at that time.
Well, this is what he's trying to say over here. Exactly. Uh-huh. Of course, remember what he's talking about over here is the fact that the authority of what the rabbis say is derived from Mount Sinai, just as the written Torah is derived from Mount Sinai. This is what he's trying to point out. Okay. And then he says not only that, Umasha Sofer Masidim Lechadesh. And he even showed him some of the innovations that later scholars would make, which of course were accepted, okay? Meaning what? What innovation? The answer is Mikra Megillah, the reading of the Megillah. Because in the final analysis, the Torah was written long before the events that took place, right? But the authority, the sanctity, you know, the importance of reading the Megillah, this mitzvah, which our sages, ordained, okay, for the people of Israel, it has the same authority as the Torah itself. Of course, there are some other, what we call, mitzvahs of the Rabbanan, right, that they added, which were not part of the original 613 commandments, but nevertheless, which we observe to this very day. One of them is, for example, benching licht. It's a mitzvah to bench licht for Shabbos and Yontov, correct? So, you know, in the Gemara and Sacher Shabbos, they want to find out what is the reasoning behind it, and they come to the conclusion it's because of Shalom Bayis. You have harmony at home if you have light in the house on Shabbos, okay? Instead of sitting around in blackness and darkness.
Right.
So, but the point is, we have accepted it upon ourselves as a mitzvah to be fulfilled from generation to generation. Another one would, of course, be also the Ner Chanukah. Lighting the candles on the Chanukah.
Oh.
But obviously, that's even later an innovation as compared to the reading of the Megillah. Of course, it happened in a later period in history, right? But nevertheless, but the point is that the sages who ordained that we have to observe Chanukah, so it becomes, you know, a similar commandment that we observe. Of course, we may have differences of opinion among the authorities as to each and every little individual item and how to observe it, but that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about that the general idea, this was already shown to Moshe Rabbeinu, and he could see, you know, what are some of the, what shall we say, long-term effects of the teachings that he had on Mount Sinai. It's a very interesting Gada that we have, that Beresh Leilam wanted to show Adam, you know, what future generations would be like. What kind of, you know, descendants would he have among mankind? So he showed him, you know, like Moshe Rabbeinu, showed him Akiva, and things like that, right? And the story goes on to say that Moshe Rabbeinu took a look at Akiva and heard what he was saying, and he didn't recognize a lot of the things that Akiva was saying, because, you know, in between, Jewish law, you know, had developed again and again and again and again, you see. Right. Expanded, developed.
So much,
but nevertheless,
Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't understand what he was saying.
Right, yeah.
I read somewhere that at the time when Moshe Rabbeinu was shown Rabbi Akiva, he hadn't yet learned the Torah.
Right.
One of the opinions.
This is what we learned with you before you went through operation, that at the Zagadah that you were relating.
Yeah.
And when it was related to him, Moshe had not yet learned the entire, and that had not been explained to him the entire Torah. So that was one reason why he couldn't follow up. But then, as you say, he got to a point where he did recognize exactly what Hashem had told him, so he said, "Oh, okay, now I feel good. I know what's going on."
Right. Okay.
Good story.
Yes, it is. Right. Okay. Now we start a new Mishnah over here, and here we're reading into something. Okay. It says, "Hakol kosher mikrosas hamigila." Everyone is kosher when it comes to reading the Megillah. Chutz, with the exception meh, that means except for cheresh, Shota the Katan, except for who? A cheresh is a person who is deaf. Usually it means deaf and dumb, but here it means specifically deaf, okay? Shota is somebody, he's a... No. Shota means an imbecile.
Oh,
an imbecile. An imbecile. Shota is an imbecile, okay?
Right, just above it.
Okay? And the Katan is a minor child, right? Rabbi Yehuda Marsha B'Katan, but Rabbi Yehuda says that it's kosher if the Katan reads, that it's okay. Now, obviously, what are they talking about? Are they talking about to simply take a Megillah and to read it for yourself? Then in that case, they don't have to lay down that long, okay? So they're talking for somebody who is going to be reading it for other people, you see. And what they're saying is that if it was a person who is deaf, then he cannot enable another person to fulfill the mitzvah, okay? And if he is a shoter, in other words, somebody who is very erratic and he's imbecile, there's a Mishnah in which they give a definition of a shoter. A shoter is somebody who cannot hang on to what he has. In other words, he's always losing things. And also, he says, he's alarmed by quarrels. Instead of going to sleep in an ordinary place, in a house and so on, he likes to go and lie down and sleep in the cemetery. So, somebody like that is an imbecile. Okay, he's a shaker. All right. So, obviously, he's not 100% in possession of his mental faculties. Okay? So, if he would read it for people who are, then he would not be AC, okay? Now, with a cotton is... Okay, it's a good question. What do we mean by cotton? Normally, a cotton is, in the case of a boy, someone has not yet reached the age of bar mitzvah. In other words, he's not 13 in a day, okay? In the case of a girl, then someone who has not yet reached the age of 12 years in a day, okay?
Yeah.
Now, if you remember, in the case of a girl, we had two different stages. One is Yalda, and the other one is Nara. And then after that, you have Bogeris. This is what we learned when we had the Gemara, you know, when we studied Kedushin, where it's a very important thing, okay? So there we learned that, for example, the Yalda, you know, that's up to the age of 12. She's a katana, that, you know, until that particular point, and therefore there's certain rules in the Torah that apply to her, okay? Nara is already someone who has passed the age of 12 in a day, but up to 12 and 6 months, okay? That's a period, a very restricted period. And then beyond that, she is a bogeris. She's an adult woman.
She's a
okay.
What?
She's bogeris, which means
bogeris. Oh,
bogeris,
yeah.
Yeah, and which means an adult woman, okay? Okay, yeah. Some of us feel that some of our daughters maybe are still katanas, even when they're past the age of being a bogeris. But that's why do we feel that? Well, maybe we baby them more than previous generations did. I don't know. All right. So the question is, first of all, yeah, and then as we said, the last part of the Mishnah said, but Rabbi Yehuda gives permission. He says that it's okay if a cotton reads, you know, for people who obviously are not katanim, but who are older, okay? So the Gemara says, Man Tana, who is the authority who taught Cheresh, right? The one who taught that, what? That where it says, you know, that HaKol Shein L'Kos Chutz B'Cheresh, right, except for somebody who is deaf, right? So the implication of the Mishnah would be what? Would be the avid nomi. No. That if he had already read, then in that particular case, the thing is invalid. You understand?
Yeah.
And of course, then you would have to have reading all over again in order to enable people who had heard the Cheresh, you know, in order to fulfill the mitzvah of reading the beginning. So we have Master. So Rav Master said, Rav Yossi, he says, that authority in the Mishnah, you know, it's not mentioned over here, but that would coincide with what? With the viewpoint of Rabbi Yossi. Ditlan, as we have heard, we learned in the Mishnah, in this case, this goes back to the Gemara in Brachas, if you remember, it says, HaKorei Shema, if a person reads Kriya Shema, the Lehi Hishmia LeYosno, and he did not let his ear hear what he was saying, Yotza, right? This is what the Chachamim say, that if a person reads Shema, but he did not say it so that his ears could actually hear what he's saying, nevertheless, they say that he has fulfilled the obligation of reading Shema.
That's interesting.
Well, that's the Chachamim say that, okay? Mm-hmm. But Rabbi Yossi Omer, but Rabbi Yossi says, Lo Yotza, right? That he did not fulfill the mitzvah. So, if that's the case, they see that there's a parallel here to what the Mishnah here says about, you know, the Cheresh, you know, because he can't hear what he is saying. You understand? He can't hear what he's saying. I mean, he can visualize it, but he can't hear it, actually. It's not audible to him. Right. So this is what the Mishnah says. This is what the Gemara says concerning the anonymous author of the Mishnah. But they say it's in accordance with the views of Rabbi Yosef. Okay. I did point out to you, when we studied the Gemara of Brachas, that the view of the Chachamim actually is the accepted halacha. But nevertheless, there is a moral implication that Shema, you should really make every effort, you know, that when you say it, it should be audible at least to yourself. I don't mean to say it out loud so that, you know, you shine louder than everybody else, but it should be audible to you, even as, you know, Rabbi Yossi suggests. I mean, this is more correct to do it that way. Figuratively, we could say that when you say something, you should hear what you yourself are saying.
Watch your language.
Watch your language. If you make a commitment, stick to it, and so on. Be careful what you have to say. Okay? Whether that Shema that we find in the early pages of the Siddur, you know, as part of the Brachas, is for that reason or not, I know it's the first time I hear it from you. But the business, you know, about why do we say Shema Yisrael is part of the Musaf on Shabbos and Yom Tov? In the Kedusha, you know.
Right,
yeah, when we say Kedusha, you know, we say Shema Yisrael, who are the Kedusha, and then what do we conclude with? Miyos Lachem and Lachim, right? Adi Yad Hashem Lachem, which is, of course, the conclusion of the third paragraph of the Shema. So there the answer that traditionally has been given, you know, is the fact that the Roman authorities forbade the recital of the Shema, and so they wanted to, the Jews wanted to do it in such a way that they weren't saying the Shema, but at the same time, you know, they were thinking the Shema when they said it.
Was that in the era of Hadrian, Hadrianus, or what?
Yeah, it could be Hadrian, it could be Trajan, you know. They had different people who unfortunately issued edicts against the study of Torah and who persecuted Jews who learned Torah and who practiced Yiddishkeit. Yes. Well, one advantage of saying it early is that if you say it, you know, when you get up, so the chances are that you're still saying it within the recommended time for saying the Shema Yisrael, okay? Whereas if you wait, you know, to say Shema Yisrael, the way we do on a Shabbos morning, 9:30, 10, 10:30, whatever it may be, at this time of the year it's considered as not being the optimum time. Okay, I don't want to get into a dispute with Rabbi Kornblau, but because the Gemara itself...
Would it be the first hour?
The first 3 hours.
First three hours.
Right.
And what do you call the first hour, 6?
No, that's fine when it is 6 o'clock. That's at the equinox, it would be so. If you would take a look right now, you know when sun rises in the morning? Officially, it's about 5:14, 5:15 in the morning, right? So 8 o'clock is already getting on, you know, right? 9 or 9:30 definitely is much later, and so on, yeah. I won't mention, you know, but there is a congregation here in town that doesn't begin before 10 o'clock in the morning, you know. So that definitely is way beyond the time. All right. At any rate. Yes. Yeah, well, you should say the three of them together, right. But we don't. I mean, what we do is, you know, something like... Yeah. So the Gemara itself, in talking about the Shema Yisrael, they give different opinions as to what is the obligation of Shema. I mean, everybody agrees you say three paragraphs, but yet, one opinion is that if you just say Shema Yisrael, that's that verse alone, you have already fulfilled the mitzvah of reciting Shema, even though you haven't done the rest of it, right? Another one says up to Vishvarecha, okay. Yeah. So, doesn't mean that the halacha follows these things, but nevertheless, there is something to fall back upon, you see.
You get credit,
absolutely. Okay, so now we're trying to establish the fact. Okay, so apparently it seems to be Rabbi Yossi, who is the author of the statement that a cheresh, right, can not enable other people to fulfill their obligation. Okay? So now they say, umimai, and how do we know, the Rabbi Yossi, the Deyevet Namile, that this really represents the opinion of Rabbi Yossi, and if it was done, then the Yevet Namilo, then there's definitely no fulfillment of the obligation. You have to do it all over again, right? It says, Dilma Rabbi Yehudahi. Maybe it's not Rabbi Yossi's opinion, but the Mishnah represents the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Ulechat Chivahu, the law. And what he's saying is, to begin with, a Cheresh should not read the Megillah to enable others to fulfill it, right? But however, if he did it already, then Shabbatami. Then in that case, it's all right. He has fulfilled the obligation. Understand?
But Rabbi Yehuda is saying this? This is what this is
really. Well, this is the argument right now. All right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the argument. Okay. So it says, no, you cannot imagine, he says, the Kotene, that because in the Mishnah itself, we learn that Cheresh Dumya the Shet of the Cotton, right? That there is a parallelism in the Mishnah here between the person who has no hearing, right? And the person who is either an imbecile or who is a minor.
Yeah.
All right? Whereas, and just as the Mishnah says, Ma Shet of the Cotton, the Yevet Namilo, just as if it were an imbecile, or if it were a minor who read, then you don't fulfill it, even if it's already been done, right? The other. So, af cheresh de evet namilem. So then we have to say that the person who is deaf, if he's done it, then the mitzvah is not fulfilled, and you have to do it all over again, right? The hokedeisa. And maybe it could be one or it could be the other. So it says midikatone sefer. When we take a look now at the last part of this Mishnah, it says Rabbi Yehuda Machshiv Kotan, that Rabbi Yehuda gives permission, you know, in the case of a minor, that if he read it, okay, so the klal, then from this we have to come to the conclusion, the Reish Alav, that the first part says that it's no good. So they say, so in that case, Rabbi Yehuda, that follows the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Redeemer Kula Rabbi Yehuda, but maybe the entire Mishnah represents the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. And he says, Midami Reshad of Sula, the Sefer Lekshava. And can we compare the fact that the first part of the Mishnah says that what they've done is invalid, right? And the ending, the last part of the Mishnah says that it is kosher. You understand? Follow the reading of the Mishnah again. Starts by saying everybody is okay except for Cheresh Shot of the Cotton. So in that case, what do we have to say? Since the Cheresh Shot of the Cotton is no good, right? And then along comes Rabbi Yehuda and he says that the cotton is kosher, is okay. So the question is, you know, so how does this relate? Right?
I guess what they're arguing is that if by validating the cotton, they can, by inference, validate
So how can you compare the first part of the Mishnah, which invalidates, and the last part, which makes a kosher? Right? And maybe the entire Mishnah represents Rabbi Yehuda. And maybe he's talking about two different types of cotton, not one type of cotton. In other words, we said before that technically cotton is somebody up to the age of 13 and a day, right? But maybe we're talking about two different divisions in the lifetime of a cotton. Namely, that the first few years, obviously, we know when they're little children, they certainly cannot enable an adult to fulfill an obligation, you understand? But maybe as they get close to the age of Bar Mitzvah,
where they already had several years of education and they know what they're doing. So we say that the Kotan, who's Shehigia Lechinuch. In other words, a minor who has already had enough educational experience so that he knows halachas, he understands what he's doing, so maybe that type, it would be permissible, you know. You understand? This is what they're arguing now. Alright, so, and the chasura mechasura. And in that case, the Mishnah has left out something that we have to supply. The Hochi Katani, and this is how we should understand the Mishnah. Hakol kisherin likros hamigira, right? Every man is valid, is kosher, when it comes to the ability to read the Megillah and enable others to fulfill the mitzvah. Chutz becherisha to the katan, right? Except for that, so far this is the language of the Mishnah. Now, what do you have? Bamed v'amamirim. Now, what are we talking about over here? We're talking about the Kotan Shalohigia Lechinuch, right? We're talking about a child who's not yet absorbed enough education in Yiddishkeit. About the Kotan Shalohigia Lechinuch, but if we're talking about a child who has reached the age of education, then Afilu L'chatchila, then even to begin with, it would be okay, Rabbi Yehuda Machshir B'Katan, right? That Rabbi Yehuda says that it's okay. He validates it, right? Says, Baba Niko to Rabbi Yehuda, with the Eved, Elohadet Tani Rabbi, let me back down a little bit. Okay. So far, maybe then Rabbi Yehuda is of the opinion that even L'chatchila, even to begin with, he validates the reading of the Megillah by a minor and enable the adult to fulfill the obligation. Maybe that's what he's saying, right?
You know, this poses an interesting question. Once Rabbi Yehuda starts to differentiate, which makes a lot of sense, between the two categories of children, from the little that I know about people that are deaf, you can differentiate between different classifications of deafness. There are people that can understand and can hear some sounds and can have partial hearing, but not to that of a normal level. And there are those people that really have no hearing at all.
Right.
So that you can make the same differentiation in the argument.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah, it's possible. Of course, I don't say what I mean today, but we have all kinds of hearing aids.
Right, that's another point, right?
That particular case has certainly changed the picture, doesn't it?
That's another interesting element.
Yeah.
My
wife. It's always a problem when they talk about somebody who's just begun to have education. Obviously, you can't read for your high read. But beyond that, you want somebody who reads with understanding. If you foreclose the possibility altogether, then you don't open yourself up to all of these possibilities of who lives in the knowledge.
Yeah.
What is the beginning of learning?
Well, I don't have to tell you. Normally, when we're talking about Kotel Shegiel Chinuch, what we have in mind is that he has a substantial Jewish education to begin with.
Is this the reader you're talking about?
To read, right. As I said before, to simply pick up a Megillah and read for yourself, there's no issue of that, okay? But to read for other people, this is the question. Right. In general, we feel that once a child reaches a certain age, then it is a mitzvah for us as parents, to educate that child in brachas, in Yiddishkeit, and how to daven, and chumash, and etc., you understand? And also to show them how do we perform mitzvahs. For example, when my sons were young, I had to make kiddush on Friday night around the table. They made it for themselves. I made it, of course, for Anne, right? But I had them also recite it. Why? Because I wanted them to know how to recite kiddush by the time that, when they're responsible to do it on their own. And so on. And, the same idea being that, for example, one person could light a Hanukkah candle for the entire family.
yet they consider, you know, that it's even better if the children, you know, light their own Hanukkah candles, because it adds. They're learning something, and they thought, that's right, and it makes the house more yontifik and so on. So, but, you know, this is also about a Yigielachim.
Did you have each son, each Friday night, say the bracha, or did you alternate Friday nights?
No, I had each of them say it. I mean, when they reach a certain age, obviously, until, you know, because I wanted them to know how to, you know.
Saying they would go lighting candles up there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There are many people who follow the, you know, the Lubavitch or the Hasidic custom, whatever it is, that the girls also light together with their mothers.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So, at any rate, then it is possible, according to this interpretation, that Rabbi Yehuda would give permission to a katan to read, even to start with, all right? Even, as we would say, the chatchila. Others say that what he's saying is that only it's with the eved, okay? Namely that if he had already done, then we say that it's kosher, it's valid. But in any case, but as we say, we have to also interpret that the katan that we're talking about over here is one who has already reached an age where he knows how to read and he understands what he's reading, and that way he enables other people to fulfill their mitzvah. Okay. So he says, okay. So what are we talking about? That we establish it like according to Rabbi Yehuda, b'diyavet. And we say that when he says that it's b'diyavet. In other words, if the cotton did it, then in that particular case, it's valid. Elohadotli, Rabbi Yehuda, b'diyavet, Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi. But now let's get back.